Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 3:28 p.m. and that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 13th. I'm recording a little later today. I was in Florida this morning, so just off the plane. But it's been an interesting day. Personally, I was expecting Wall Street to do a bit better today, but it finished pretty much unchanged. I think a lot of the positive sentiment towards the possibility of a trade deal was already priced in. That's certainly not the case, though, with the UK. And the landslide victory that Boris Johnson has delivered has certainly delivered clarity. I thought this chart I produced earlier in the week is particularly instructive because it clearly demonstrates the habitual outperformance of the FTSE 250 relative to the FTSE 100 since approximately 1999. We can also see that there have been pretty lengthy periods where the FTSE 100 outperformed for a brief period and then they performed more or less in line with one another. That was particularly true in 2001 and 2. It was again true between approximately 2007 and 2010. And it was true again between 2016 and 2019. But this week we've seen a clear break on the upside by the FTSE 250 relative to the FTSE 100. And that does suggest that this relative outperformance is being reasserted on the upside. The domestic UK stock market is trading at a really rather significant discount to other developed markets. And of course, the reason for that is because of the uncertainty over the last 3 years with regard to Brexit and what it meant for the economy. Well, it's looking increasingly likely that the transition deal is going to be passed by Parliament when it goes back into session in January. Then the big question is going to turn to how long is it really going to take the Johnson government to negotiate a trade deal with the EU. He has a large majority, and there is no reason to go back to the polls until the full term of his government has expired. Well, that could be potentially 2023. That, I think, is probably the real deadline for a deal with the EU. Trying to get it done before the end of 2020, when the transition agreement won't even be ratified until the beginning of January, well, that is a very tight timetable, and I think it's potentially unrealistic. But of course, what Boris Johnson brings to the table is a clear willingness to push the buttons of the EU and to say that if they don't agree to his terms, that they will simply leave with a no deal environment. And we can anticipate that that is going to be part of the brinksmanship that arises as part of the negotiation process. In fact, I'd be rather disappointed if we don't get that. But what it does suggest is we're not quite yet at the end of volatility. But what we certainly appear to be at is the end of weakness for the pound. And the pound surged in early trading today. It wasn't quite able to hold on to all of it, but it went from 120 to 135 in the space of just the last few months. That is a rollicking performance, and generally speaking, when you get a move of that magnitude, it's quite likely that we're going to get at least some consolidation. The most important point, though, is that it has clearly broken the downward bias from the peak in 2018. When we look at it versus the euro, then we have really quite clear evidence of a breakout. But we have an even wider short-term overbought condition. It has raced from the failed break below on the lower side of the range to break out to new highs. Now the question is, how much of this advance can it hold? I rather do think that it is more than likely that the pound is probably going to advance from here over the course of the next year and more, but it is not going to continue to go up in such a straight line. Even in the most bullish of scenarios, it is still a competitive currency environment. Europe doesn't want a strong currency, but neither does the UK. They have a clear incentive to try and keep the currency as weak as possible to try and encourage economic activity, and most particularly in view of the renewed animal spirits that we're getting in the UK once more. But there is the other important point, is that UK yields and are at a rather important juncture. When we look at the gilt yield, it has been trending higher since the nadir of the yield back in August, and it paused in the region of the trend mean in here today. This 50 basis point level offered support back in 2016 as well. So we are still in a potentially a distribution phase for government bonds. The Bank of England has been chomping at the bit to raise interest rates, but they just haven't been able to do that because of the uncertainty with regard to Brexit. And it is very unlikely that they're going to be able to raise interest rates for the next year either, and not least because of the competitive disadvantage that would put the UK at on an interest rate basis. If the Bank of England were to try and raise rates, then that would really turn into a tailwind for the currency and have a deleterious effect on the economy. But I think it is important to look at, for example, the valuations that we see on shares in the UK. For example, the FTSE 100 has got a yield of 4.89%, and it's got a PE of 15. Well, that is more than double the yield that is currently available on the S&P 500. And there are a substantial number of shares that have got attractive yields. Lloyd's is an example, with about 5% and an estimated PE of under 9. When we then think about, for example, the Royal Mail, quite whether the 10.36% dividend is going to be sustained or not, even if they have the dividend, it's still going to be 5%. And then again here, the estimated PE is really not challenging at 11.48. I think most important point is to think about not only the yields that are available, but also the chart patterns. Royal Dutch Shell, for example, has been pulling back rather acutely over the course of the last couple of months. It's now below the 2200p level, and it has not yet been able to push back up into that range. And of course, it is being weighed on by the low oil price, or the low natural gas price in particular. But that yield is getting up there. It's coming back up towards 7%, and that should at least partially cushion the share price. But natural gas is the company's bread and butter, and natural gas prices are not trending higher. They're right in the region of the low, around $2. There is rather a lot of natural gas around. I've also started to see these articles from the Green Lobby talking about the amount of methane that escapes from various oil fields and drilling rigs, and there is probably going to be increasing scrutiny of the fact that that natural gas tends to get flared off if it doesn't, if it is not just simply escaping into the atmosphere. That could potentially raise the cost of drilling, but what natural gas really needs is a really good, strong cold front across most of the USA to stoke demand. The simple fact of the matter is that there's plenty of it around, and the global LNG market is continuing to grow. Australia now has as much export capacity as Qatar, and Qatar is investing rather heavily in additional new supply because they want to sustain their market-leading position. with that quantity of gas hitting the market, it's inevitable that we're going to have additional sources of new demand, whether that is in the direct provision of proteins from chemical processes that can turn gas into protein directly, whether that is the evolution of hydrogen fuel cells, and particularly as range extenders, or whether it is because of a return to demand growth in the global economy, because I think it is quite likely we are past the trough in global growth. What is, I think, rather interesting is the market that has been got the lowest valuations, the strong, and now getting a stronger currency, and the lack of these worries is the UK. It has been really off the radar for the vast majority of investors for most of the last 3 years, and really longer than that. It looks increasingly likely that the valuation on the UK is going to at least come up, and certainly the compression of yields is likely to compress down to the kinds of yields that we're seeing elsewhere. But there might be a bit of push and pull to that, because when, for example, we look at the German 10-year yield, it's now at minus 28 basis points. It's right in the region of the trend mean. I think it is quite likely we are going to see these yields pushing up from here. The reality is that inflationary pressures are rising, and they're not just rising in the USA. They're rising everywhere. The continuous commodity index has broken its downtrend, and it was up in dynamic fashion this week. It is looking increasingly likely that we are going to see this go all the way back up to the upper side of this range that's persisted for nearly 4 years, but it need not stop there. Then when we look at the oil price, Brent crude has been hovering here around the $65 area for most of the last 6 months. It has failed on every other occasion to try and push above it, but it did close above $65 this week. There has been a sequence of higher reaction lows over the course of the last 3 months, and if it can sustain a move above $65, well, then that is going to hold out the prospect of a push back up towards the $80 area. But I think we do have to also give some consideration not just to the short term but to the longer term. And I think it is interesting that when we look at the Dow Gold ratio, well, what that gives us is a graphic illustration of major bull and bear markets. It really quite accurately highlights the fact that when commodities do well, stock markets don't do particularly well. And when we get the stock market doing well, commodities don't generally tend to do especially well. Well, then when we think about what's going on in terms of this interplay between the two asset classes, we've had some major bull and bear market cycles. And that is particularly true of the peaks in the equity market. We've had one in 1999, we had another in 1965. I just don't know why this chart isn't going back with all the history that it normally does. But when we look at these very long-term ratios, well, what we're really being presented with are these peaks that are approximately 36 years apart. That would suggest that the next major peak is going to be somewhere around 2030. Now, if we then look at the Dow oil ratio, what I find really interesting is the commonality that we see in terms of the pattern, because we have a lot of long-term history for the oil price. We also have a lot of long-term history for the Dow Jones, so we can look at these longer-term ratios. And again, here we see this peak in 1929, the peak in the late 1960s, and then another peak in 1999. Each of those peaks is higher than the last. And by and large, they do come down to test the anywhere from 100 times to the 21 time levels. And there are two occasions when it did that, but there are also two occasions when it didn't, and it only got down to 60. Well, that would suggest that the levels that we saw at in 2008 and 9 are probably as low as it's going to go, and that what we're being presented with now is that this is a mid-cycle slowdown in terms of the secular bull market. My view for much of the last 10 years has been that the oil bull market is over, and that we are in a prolonged ranging phase that is likely to be from approximately $40 to $80 for the foreseeable future. That opens up the door for a continued bull market on equities. And that is, I think, one of the clearest consistencies that we have in terms of the long-term cycle. Then when we look at the S&P 500, it has had three ranges in terms of this decade-long bull market. And when we think about what that looks like in terms of moving averages, I think it is really quite important for a longer-term investor to be aware of the longer-term moving averages. Now, I'm not at all sure why it doesn't show it when I put in a weekly chart, or when I put in a monthly chart, but I'm going to put it in anyway for the weekly chart. And then what we are presented with is some support being found in the region of the trend mean during these medium-term corrections. A 1,000-day moving average is not an unreasonable trend mean for a secular bull market. It also worked particularly well in the early phases of the bull market, from the lows in 1982 all the way up to approximately 1995. Then the bubble phase really did get going, and one would have had to tighten or look at a different moving average. But we definitely then had the clear evidence that the bull market was over in 2001, if one hadn't already concluded that based upon the size of the reaction relative to the very wide overextension. But the big picture then is that this market now is becoming increasingly easy to monitor, because the minimum requirement to question the secular bull market hypothesis would be a sustained move below the 1,000-day moving average. And we just haven't seen that in nearly 10 years. What it also means is that the 1,000-day moving average is an important locus of support during these medium-term corrective phases, which have generally lasted about a year and a half. But it's also worth considering that the trending phases have also tended to last about a year and a half. Well, we pushed onto new high ground for the first time in June of this year. There's been a succession of higher reaction lows since the big pullback in December of last year. And what that suggests is that we probably have a good run on the upside all the way through the fourth year of the presidential cycle. Well, the US presidential cycle generally follows a reasonably persistent pattern, that the first year is not especially good. It's the worst year of the presidential cycle, because Generally speaking, they prime the pump in the last year and they start paying for all that spending in the first year of the new administration. So we're now approaching the final year. It's usually in the second half of the third year that there is a growth scare, and then the central bank starts to move in to support the economy, and they loosen the purse strings. Well, that's exactly what we've had this year. And we did have a little bit of a wobble in the middle of this year. Between that initial peak in June and the, or sorry, the initial peak in April and the pullback into the beginning of June, there was a lot of questioning about whether we are still in a bull market, whether we can't simply anticipate that there isn't that the major top is in place, or that the trade war was going to cause a crash. I think everybody will remember that. But since then, the market has broken on the upside. Now, if the pattern that has held over the course of the last decade persists, then we can anticipate that this market will continue to trend higher until we get the election. I do think that the US presidential election, based upon the cyclicality of the presidential election, is likely to be a significant catalyst, that there is the real potential too. When we think about the trade war is not over. What the phase one deal suggests is that China will start buying more of the USA's agricultural commodities, and that is particularly true of soybeans. But I think it is worth highlighting that the soybean price wasn't up in an especially dynamic manner in here this week. Or when, for example, we look at the corn price. Corn prices are steadying, but they're certainly not breaking upwards in a dynamic manner just yet. That suggests that the market is still a little bit leery of taking China at its word. When we then think about the semiconductors index, well, it has been doing spectacularly well, and it is short-term overbought. It wasn't quite able to hold on to all of the advance in here this week. Well, the other point, of course, is that China will have been stockpiling semiconductor components because of the real potential that they could have been locked out of the market. If we are now at the end of at least the first phase of the trade war, then there will be less requirements on stock building, and that could be a headwind for the semiconductors index. The counterbalance to that argument is that a lot of the CEOs who have been expressing angst about the trade war and what it's doing to their businesses will start to order again and start reinvesting in capital development when that uncertainty disappears. Well, I think what that suggests is we have a recipe now for some consolidation. We do have a short-term overbought condition, and I think it is likely we're going to get a pause in consolidation. If we then think about bonds again, 10-year Treasury yields are also right in the region of the trend mean, but they did not hold all of the advance here today. And the dollar was firmer in here today and was off its lows that it opened at. There is a short-term oversold condition. Every time it has pulled back below the trend mean, it has rebounded back above it in pretty short order. And that's what we're going to have to see again in the next couple of weeks if the dollar bullish environment is going to be reasserted. But there are reasons to think why that may not be the case. All the way through 2018 and into the beginning of this year, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates, and they were also reducing the size of their balance sheet. Well, they are just, they're not doing either anymore. They're in fact increasing the size of the balance sheet, and this is still a very meaningful move. Going from 3.75 to 4.1 trillion is $350 billion worth of stimulus in the space of less than 3 full months. And that's aggressive by any measure. It is already well on the way to completely unwinding the quantitative tightening efforts that had been underway before the Federal Reserve got schooled by the markets. There is a long history of new central bankers being educated in the requirements for excess liquidity by the markets. And that is the catalyst for, or at least it was the catalyst for, the initial decline in in January of 2018. The fact that Powell kept going on and raised rates 3 times in 2018 was enough to really put the cat among the pigeons and stir fear in terms of investor sentiment by December of 2018, when the markets were selling off rather aggressively. The pullback of just about 20%, it was in fact 20% on an intraday basis, not quite 20% on a closing basis. Well, that is a very narrow avoidance of a 20% correction. When people talk about the fact that this is the longest expansion in history, well, they're obviously looking at closing prices and not intraday prices. I think the more important point is that it isn't about the length of the recovery. It's more about the strength of the recovery. This economic expansion has been weaker than other economic expansions. We haven't had the same boom-bust cycle. There has been a much more modest pace of advance. That doesn't mean that we can't have a recession later. I rather think that we are at a point now where we are going to start to see valuations increase. I think when we look at the cyclically adjusted PE ratio, there is an argument that comparing the valuation and the earnings that we have from corporations today is not really an apples for apples comparison with that with the historical record, simply because there are so much more international earnings coming through today than that was ever the case in the 1980s or earlier than that. The clear ability of companies to generate outsized profits from a global business without having to have a big international footprint, and the fact that it is companies like Microsoft and Apple and Google and Facebook that are dominating the market cap of the major markets, well, that is a testament to the low capital requirements that they have. The problem for a company like Facebook is they're increasingly being targeted because of the control they exert on the social sphere. And the share is now pausing around the 200 level. When we then think about what's going on in terms of Google, well, they have been able to break on the upside. It's found support in the region of the upper side of this range. They have not yet been legislated against in terms of the vast control that they have over the internet and how people find things on the internet. The logical response to consolidation and capitalism trends towards consolidation, where the strongest consume the weakest. But the natural conclusion to that is the taking over of businesses, and that because of that consolidation, you're going to have people worried about all those takeovers, worried about the monopolization of opportunity that these companies are able to claim, and then that leads to antitrust. Well, we're beginning to have those kinds of discussions. We're not perhaps quite ready to break up these kinds of companies because it's difficult to frame exactly what might what might a Facebook that is not a monopolist look like? How do you break up a company like Google when the majority of their revenue comes from search? It was, I think, easier to break up a company like Microsoft. They suffered from antitrust. But the share is still trending higher, and the pace of the advance now is continuing to do well. Well, what this also helps to ram home is that even companies that have to go through a period of antitrust can do well subsequently. Wage growth is starting to increase. We saw evidence of that in Germany just this week, and German wage growth is running at about 3%. In the USA, it's running at about 3.1%. I think it is worth highlighting that wage growth going up towards 5% has been a lead indicator of trouble. It's currently running around 3.1%, so it is at an elevated level. A significant number of sectors are running at full capacity, and against a background where wage demand growth is rising, that would naturally start to push up interest rates, but we're not seeing that. There is just too much dependence on a continued availability of liquidity in the markets that it's going to be rather difficult to raise interest rates from here. Well, with wage demands going up, a desire not to raise interest rates, and governments lining up to spend money hand over fist and run significant deficits, all of that suggests that the potential here is that we're going to see inflation picking up. And that is, I think, starting to come through in places like the USA and in Germany. Well, the MDAX index in Germany, it would be the equivalent of the FTSE 250 in the UK. It pushed on to a new high in here this week. The FTSE 250 also broke on the upside to hit a new all-time high, although I think it is looking somewhat overbought in the short term. When we then think about what's going on in terms of Japan, the second section has been resurgent over the course of the last month. The Nikkei 225 is back in the region of the upper side of its range. And again, we do have a short-term overbought condition, but there is, I think, potential here that Japan is going to be pushing on the upside. The social unrest that's been emerging in Hong Kong is obviously an obstacle to investor interest, but valuations are reasonably attractive, with the yield of about 3.58% and a PE of about 10.7, or 10.8 really. But the bigger picture is that it has held the sequence of higher reaction lows. It's coming back into the region of the trend mean now. There's potential that we're going to see additional upside. I do rather think of China as a trader's market rather than an investor's market. It is not the kind of place I would be comfortable putting money in coming back in 10 years, just simply because of the massive uncertainty with regard to just what the Communist Party is going to decide to do. The A-share index, though, was in positive territory in here today, and the Hang Seng was also positive. So, considering the fact that it was Chinese growth was one of the biggest, or one of the markets, let me put that a different way, China's economy was one of the biggest victims of the trade war. And with at least an easing of that anxiety about trade wars, then there is potential here for the market to do better. When we look at markets like Brazil, then the index there is now pushing on the upside in a really quite dynamic manner. The Brazilian real is strengthening. It's coming back to test the region of the trend mean. I'm not going to be really satisfied that the real has found a low of more than short-term significance until it is trading below the trend mean. When we look at what's going on in India, the rupee has been strengthening against a background where the RBI did not cut rates. They're still worried about inflation. But what is going on in the background in India, I think, is much more important. What you're seeing now is a lot more articles being written about the more authoritarian aspect that the Modi administration is adopting, particularly with regard to undocumented arrivals from neighboring countries. But from a market's perspective, the more important point is that they have cut corporate taxes. They are trying to tackle the problems with non-performing loans in the non-bank lending sector. They are streamlining the state-owned banks. They have introduced reforms in the labor market. And those are all highly growth stimulative over the medium to long term. Now, that doesn't mean that the Indian market isn't emotional and volatile. It is. And the index today was in positive territory. It has been consolidating here around the 12,000 level. I think this is not the time that we can anticipate there's going to be a very big drawdown, but there is the potential that we will get drawdowns in the future, and those have universally been some of the most attractive buying opportunities that one could wish for in the Indian market. So I think there is scope for additional upside here simply because investors are going to be encouraged into the market because of the reforms that are being put in place. And these are really very significant reforms. They're the kind of reforms that people have been waiting years for in India. The simple fact is that India has 600 million people under the age of 25. And that kind of demographic dividend is probably not going to be repeated in another country ever. The global birth rate has already peaked. The global population is continuing to increase because people are living longer. One of the biggest areas of investigative medicine is in prolonging life. And there is this phenomenon in Silicon Valley where they are now treating death as a disease and looking at the causes of death and attempting to combat them. What is also interesting is that Biogen has reinterpreted its data, and I guess that is a kind way of saying they're trying to manipulate their data on their Alzheimer's drug. But since they announced that they were doing that, the share has bounced right back up to unwind the decline put in when they cancelled the research. But one of the side effects of the investigation of Alzheimer's has been, in mouse studies at least, that once they're taking these drugs, they appear to become more youthful. Well, what is quite likely is, in much the same way that when Viagra was first discovered, it was because it was a heart medication, and then it had other associated effects. There is a pile of money getting devoted to the investigation of prolonging life, and the potential for that to twin with Alzheimer's is something that is really potentially interesting. The one thing that can really help to drive innovation in this sector is the vast pool of willing subjects. Alzheimer's is fatal, and it has no cure. Therefore, biotech companies will be able to test new drugs on people somewhat easier than it would be the case, for example, with diabetes. that does suggest that there is scope for successful innovation in this area. I think we're at an incredibly interesting time in the biotech sector. The invention of CRISPR has vastly enhanced the speed and accuracy of genetic engineering. The speed with which and the cost of genetic sequencing has collapsed. It's one of the fastest collapses in terms of pricing for any technology. When we start to combine those two, well, then we are going to have the additional application of massive computing power in the form of deep learning and cloud computing. When that is devoted to the biotech sector, then they have a massive requirement for computing power. So when you start to think about the quantity of data that goes into a human brain being in the order of petaflops rather than megabytes or gigabytes, then we're talking about vast quantities of data. All of that is likely to be occurring in the future. We are approaching a potential point where there could be some form of customized medicine because of a greater understanding about genetics. But I think the more important thing is that we're going to get genetic solutions to chronic problems. And that is a massive game changer in terms of pricing. We're very familiar with thinking about energy as being a tax on consumption. But healthcare is a massive tax on consumption as well. Whether the healthcare is paid for either through a government or an employer or personally, one way or the other, the direct result is that there is less money in our pockets. And streamlining the creation of solutions for what are currently intractable diseases is a massive bull market enhancer. And it is the kind of thing that can provide the kind of productivity growth on which bull markets evolve. That's before we even begin to think about what is likely in the energy sector, whether it is going to be the creation of additional new demand drivers for natural gas simply on an economics 101 basis, that when you've got a lot of an economic commodity at a low price, people will figure out how to use more of it. And Moore's law, that is the wrong law. I actually can't remember the law of supply and demand. Englishman came up with it in the 1820s to think about commodity supply and demand in the coal market. But what it does tell us is that when prices go down, demand goes up, and it continues to rise over time. Well, that's something that is also applicable to other sectors. When we think about energy in particular, whether that is going to be natural gas, whether it is going to be coal and sequestration, because coal is already cheap, and there is even the potential that sequestration costs will go down, well, then that can also contribute to the ranging environment in terms of energy prices. The addition of India into the global middle class is obviously something that is going to stoke their individual energy demand. They've been certainly playing with thorium reactors, but obviously every country has to come up with at least some kind of solution to energy security, whether that is building more nuclear reactors or putting up more solar farms. Certainly, also, we know that when you put up solar, that if it gets cloudy, they don't produce any electricity. When there's wind, they don't, or with wind, if there isn't any wind, you don't get any electricity either. That either means that there's going to have to be significant investment in batteries. What we also know, though, is that the lithium price has been trending downwards now for the last few years. It's perhaps getting interesting, considering the magnitude of the decline, a halving since the middle of 2018. But there was a lot of investment went into additional new supply, and all that new supply is now coming onto the market. It's going to need a bullish catalyst, potentially in the form of renewed demand from potentially China, potentially India, or whether it is going to be the complete transition of the automotive sector from the internal combustion engine to electric vehicles. The enhancements that we're getting in batteries are, I think, a really quite significant game changer. And then, of course, we have the promise of fusion. Well, what I find particularly interesting about fusion is that the promise was always 25 years away, whereas now the promise is 5 years away. So there has certainly been some success with that. When we think about where are we in terms of the stock market cycle, I'm rather interested that people are still jumping to the conclusion of comparing the current market to 2000 and 2008. And something that David had been saying since 2009 was, how likely is it that we're going to have another 2008 in such close proximity to the last historic crisis? We do not get 100-year crises every decade. That occurred during a secular bear market. And the bear markets you get in secular bear markets are way worse than the ones you get in bull markets. Well, we have the potential for productivity growth, and we have ample liquidity. And it is that liquidity is helping to drive market prices higher. We also have the potential that inflationary pressures are going to pick up, and that they will be allowed to run hot. In other words, that interest rates will not rise, and that central banks will tolerate a somewhat higher inflation price. Well, that also helps to, I think, ram home why the gold price has been reasonably firm. It was in positive territory again today, and it's continuing to push up and through, firm from the $1,450 area. And I think this is a rather meaningful change. When we look at the kind of volatility that it put in over previous years, then this has been a clear change. The $100 pullback, the very steady environment generally, that really does point out to us that it's obviously in demand. This looks like a first step above the base. During a first step above the base, we anticipate that there is going to be a kind of conversation that runs along the lines of, wow, we've just had a big bull market, we've just had a big move on the upside, I can't possibly buy now, it's at new 7-year highs, so I'll have to wait for a pullback. Then there are going to be the bulls that say, well, I'm going to buy some anyway, and if it pulls back, I'll buy some more because I think it's a new secular bull market. The longer the range persists, there's going to be people saying, well, maybe it was a cyclical bull market, but it's going to decline any day now. There are going to be the bears that say this can't possibly be sustained. All the worries that drove gold on the upside in the first place are unsustainable, and they're starting to improve, so we can anticipate that the gold price is going to pull back again. But the most important thing during a first step above the base is that supply and demand does come back into balance, that these arguments do start to manifest, and that people do start to have some to and fro about whether it is up or down. This happens in every first step above the base, regardless of asset class. But the one incontrovertible fact is that if this range occurs above the base formation, well, that tells us that the people who do want to own it are willing to pay more for the price for whatever the asset is than they had in the previous years. And that tells us that there is a new source of demand. It might not be readily apparent what it is, and there might still be argument about what it is, but I think at the present moment we know what the new source of demand is. It's central banks. Major central banks, particularly in Eastern Europe, are buying significant quantities of gold, and so is China. And this kind of central bank buying is really quite meaningful. It is the kind of demand that can sustain prices at higher levels. Well, then if we go back and think about the dollar, there is no country wants a strong currency. The USA had been doing more to support their currency than just about anybody else over the course of the last 18 months. But that is now over. If they are increasing the size of the balance sheet and they've already cut interest rates 3 times, then that does remove some of the support from the dollar. And it rather does suggest that the 100-point level is going to be a bit of a psychological Rubicon. More importantly, if the bull market is going to be reasserted, it's going to have to sustain a move back above the trend mean. It was certainly in positive territory at the end of this week, but it has not been able to push higher. I think that we are coming towards the end of the dollar's reign, that there is potential here that emerging market currencies are going to do better, that commodity currencies are going to do better. And I think it's likely that that will occur if we are in fact at past the trough in global growth. If global growth picks back up because of the removal of at least some of the worries about tariffs and about Brexit, then if that unleashes animal spirits globally once more, then that will remove some demand for dollars. The fact that all of that growth is being bought by extraordinary monetary and fiscal measures is the reason why gold is doing better. Then when we think about the gold shares, they are at the point in the cycle where gold miners tend to stick to their knitting, and they are concentrating on production rather than M&A activity. This is exactly the point in the cycle when gold shares should be doing better. And I think with that, I will leave it for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.